Good afternoon. I will call the first meeting of the Conference Committee on House File 1870 to order. And first of all, I want to just say how excited I am to be here to be talking about an issue, an important issue that has nothing to do with football. And hopefully we can have this discussion and have it be slightly more prominent than that other issue. We have two items on the agenda today. The first is just going to be the side-by-side comparison of the two bills, the House version and the Senate version. And then we're going to take some expert testimony from Sandy Jacobs from the National Council on Teacher Quality. And I'll ask that nonpartisan staff go over the side-by-side to start with. Lisa, if you want to. Ms. Larson, just proceed when you're ready.
Thank you.
And also, members, feel free to ask for recognition of the chair for clarification before we get through. I think it's just important that we all understand the differences between the various versions here.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ms. Butler and I will go through the comparison of House File 1870, the second engrossment for the House, and House File 1870, the unofficial engrossment for the Senate. Section 1 in both documents is exactly the same. It has to do with alternative teacher licensure and clarifies that for purposes of unrequested leave of absence law currently in effect, an alternative teacher license is not a provisional license under the unrequested leave of absence statute. Section 2 in the House bill directs the school board and the exclusive bargaining representative of the teachers to negotiate a plan for unrequested leave. The plan must base unrequested leave of absence decisions on teachers' subject matter licensure fields and evaluation outcomes from the least to most effective category under the teacher evaluation law we passed last year, and from least to greatest seniority within each effectiveness category, and to be consistent with the parameters that are set out in the next section of the bill that go into effect in 2016-2017. There is also language about recalling a teacher, indicating that a school board is not required to reassign a teacher with more seniority to a different subject matter licensure field in order to accommodate the seniority claims of a teacher who is similarly licensed and effective but with less seniority. There is also language saying that a teacher holding a provisional license by definition is one who has received a waiver or variance to teach from the Minnesota Board of Teaching. In the House bill, there is also language declaring that a teacher's effectiveness category and the underlying data on that individual teacher generated as part of the evaluation process and used to determine a teacher's effectiveness category are private data on individuals. Finally, there's language stating that nothing in this provision allows a school board to use a teacher's remuneration as a basis for making unrequested leave of absence or discharge decisions. This section is effective immediately and applies to all plans that are negotiated after that date. Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, the Senate Section 2 allows for the school board and the exclusive bargaining representative of the teachers to negotiate a plan before the 2016-2017 school year that's based on, or for unrequested leave, that's based on the teacher's subject matter, licensure fields, evaluation outcomes, and seniority within the effectiveness measures. Failing negotiating the plan, the school board then can take a vote and formally decide to place that or to have an unrequested leave plan based on those same instances.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 3 in the House bill is the current law on unrequested leave of absence plans that are not negotiated. The first provision in the bill, which appears on page 3, indicates that whatever structure is created under this proposal, it would also affect consolidation and reorganization plans to the extent that they are implicated here. Also in Section 3, there's language we looked at before about recall and reassignment. And then there's language saying that a teacher who is categorized as effective or better retains a 5-year right to reinstatement. That 5-year right to reinstatement is current law. But in the case of a teacher who is categorized as ineffective or less, that term for reinstatement is reduced to 1 year. Then on page 5 of the House file, paragraph N contains the structure intended to go into effect in 2016-2017. It's as described previously. It's premised on subject matter licensure fields, evaluation outcomes from least to most effective category, and within that category, least to greatest seniority. There's similar language about reassignment. Language in the House bill reaffirming a school board's ability to renew or not renew a probationary teacher's contract as it sees fit. There's a requirement, too, to publish the unrequested leave of absence plan developed. There's a clarification, again, about the definition of provisional license, and also a statement, again, that the teacher's effectiveness category and the underlying data are private data. All of this is immediately effective except for the structure that begins in 2016-2017, which becomes effective in that school year.
Then, Mr. Chair, members, just to highlight some of the differences that the Senate had in that provision, the Senate file is relating to the recall language has language about substantially different grade level assignments added to that section or to that paragraph. And then also the Senate file includes probationary teachers in the list for the unrequested leave of absence.
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a Section 4 in the House bill for which there is no comparable Senate provision. It's a clarification with respect to teacher access to their evaluations and files. It clarifies that teachers have access to files that include teacher evaluation data under the law passed last year. Mr. Chairman, members, then we begin the provisions having to do with 122A41, teachers for the first class city school districts. This particular provision is like the language that applies to 122A40, teachers generally. It says that beginning no later than the 2016-2017 school year, the school board must discharge or demote teachers based on the criteria previously mentioned, the subject matter licensure fields, evaluation outcomes from least to most effective category, and within that confine, least to greatest seniority. It declares that teacher data for evaluation purposes are private data and requires that the plan be published. Finally, there's again a statement for teachers in first-class city school districts, indicating that a school board cannot use a teacher's remuneration as a basis for making discharge or demotion decisions.
And Mr. Chair, members, the Senate file at the outset permits the school board and the exclusive representative of the teachers to negotiate an agreement, and alternatively, if they cannot negotiate agreement, then the school board can formally decide to do the discharge and demotions based on the subject matter, licensure fields, evaluation, and the effectiveness categories.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 6 in the House file has language having to do with the recalling of teachers. It's the same language that applies in 122A40.
And then, so then, Mr. Chair, members, it's the same difference where the Senate has language about the substantially different grade level assignment to the recall parameters.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 7 in the House file does not have a comparable section in the Senate. It again has to do with ensuring teachers' access to their teacher evaluation data. And Mr. Chairman, members, Section 8 is the same in both bills, and it simply says that the provisions of this section apply with respect provisions having to do with teacher assignment apply only to the extent they are consistent with the other language in the bill.
Do members of the committee have any questions? Representative Downing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm curious, in Section 5, could you explain the Senate provision just a little bit more? It looks like we both have the same 2016-17 school year requirement for this to be in effect. And how does the Senate provision allowing a school board and the exclusive representative to negotiate a plan, how does that fit in? What's the real difference there between the House and the Senate provision?
Section 5?
Yes, and my sense is that it looks like we both have the same kind of mandate or requirement in the 2016 and 17 school year, but maybe there's something before that the Senate language allows the school board to negotiate with the representative, the bargaining representative?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, the Senate file allows, before the 2016-2017 school year, allows for the school board and the exclusive representative teachers to try to negotiate a plan to happen before the state requirement happens in 2016-2017. But if they don't come to an agreement in the negotiation, the school board can then decide and vote to come up with a plan, again, before the 2016-2017.
Okay, thank you. It's the if there isn't an agreed-upon plan, then the state plan comes in. That's what I wasn't catching. Thank you very much.
Ms. Larson, if you want to clarify what the House position is as it relates to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think it's the difference. It was the House position initially, actually, to say that the school board and the exclusive representative of the teachers may negotiate a plan, but failing to negotiate, there is an alternative, and this remains in the Senate, and it says the majority of the school board members may formally decide to develop a plan if the plan is not negotiated. That language is no longer in the House bill, but it is in the Senate bill. It was in the House bill.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Larson, the change was made from a permissive may to a must, so that in the House version, it is a must, must be agreed upon between the school district and the bargaining unit. And there isn't that backdrop with the school board, whereas the Senate version is permissive, and then the school board has unilateral authority to impose it prior to the full-blown effectiveness date. Is that correct?
Yep.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senate Counsel, I noticed that you referred to the probationary teachers in as you discussed one of the differences in the side-by-side, but actually in most of the subsequent sections in the Senate bill, the word probationary teachers is included. Do you not refer to it because once you captured it in an earlier side-by-side? And so, for example, section, and perhaps I'm not looking at Litis and Grossman, but Section 5, and as I look at the bill, you know, includes non-probationary teachers, and yet in the side-by-side, as I'm seeing the differences, it doesn't mention the probationary teachers.
Mr. Chair and Sir Bonoff, the probationary teachers come into play when in the making of the unrequested leave of absence list or doing the full discharge demotion list. And I can try to point to the, try to find the section or the page and line for you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Butler, I see the probationary teachers at several points during the the amendment, so that's what I'm wondering. Am I looking at a different version?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonoff, I'm looking at page 3 of the side-by-side. In that middle column, most of the way down to in describing the similarities and differences, it says Senate file includes probationary teachers on unrequested leave of absence list. The House file does not.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, I got that, but then it also included probationary teachers to the section that was about demotion, probationary period, discharge, or demotion.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, that's for the school districts and cities of the first class. So we have two, you know, laws there. In the cities of first class, is the discharge is referred to as discharge or demotion, and in the non-first class city school districts, it's unrequested leave of absence.
Thank you.
Ms. Larson, just to expand on the difference between the probationary language, if you could just clarify the impact that the Senate language has on, you know, within the confines of current law as it relates to probationary teachers and retaining them, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, members, under current law, in both 122A40 and 41, the language in the statute allows the school board to renew or not renew a probationary teacher as it sees fit, or something very similar to those lines. And the effect of that is to say that a school board may decide to renew a probationary teacher's contract or may decide not to renew a probationary teacher's contract for any reason or no reason, as long as it's not an illegal reason. But when you add probationary teachers to the list of unrequested leave of absence, then now you're also saying that decisions about letting a teacher go also turn on a teacher's effectiveness, which is not any longer simply a decision of keeping a teacher or not keeping a teacher, but the effectiveness category also has to be taken into account.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Larson, we actually worked pretty hard in the Senate so that that effect didn't happen, because originally when Ms. Butler drafted the amendment, the section regarding using effectiveness was also placed in the probationary teacher section of law. We did not do that because we wanted to make clear that it was not our intention to change probationary teachers from being at-will employees, that in fact they were put only in the section with regard to layoffs, so that it was clear that they were in fact at any other time of the year at will. It's just in regards to the layoff decisions.
Ms. Larson, is that your reading of the bill as it's proposed?
Mr. Chairman, members, it might be worth asking the School Boards Association as well as Education Minnesota their opinion about this, because basically I think you're creating one additional category of consideration beyond at will, and that category of consideration is the measures being used to decide who is placed on unrequested leave and what order. And one of the measures proposed here has to do with effectiveness. So if you are going to decide who goes or who stays, including probationary teachers, if a probationary teacher is rated highly effective, there might be some circumstance where the teacher, that probationary teacher, may expect to remain because that teacher is so highly rated. I'm not quite certain how it would all play out, but it might be worth asking both the school boards and Education Minnesota for their opinion about that, how that would play out.
Well, we'll keep that question in mind, and we will be having a conference committee hearing where their testimony will be heard. So, are there any other member questions? Okay, if not, we'll move to the testimony from the National Council on Teacher Quality. Ms. Jacobs.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I don't see my presentation up.
Yeah, it seems the staff has left the room to make copies, so we can wait for a minute here.
Well, in the meantime, I can just introduce myself. I'm Sandy Jacobs. I'm the Vice President with the National Council on Teacher Quality. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit research and policy group based in Washington, D.C., and we focus entirely on issues that impact the teaching profession with the goal of making sure that all students have high-quality teachers. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and really commend the efforts of the legislature to advance teacher effectiveness policies here in Minnesota and specifically to connect reduction in force policies to teacher effectiveness as well. So I see we have it. Can I give you the eye to advance it? Is that okay? It's this. Yep, perfect. Thanks. Sorry, I should have brought a remote, so I'm just going to have to keep winking over to the table to tell you when to advance. I just always like to start with a visual that shows why we engage in this work and why it's so important that state legislatures are taking up this work is teacher effectiveness matters a lot. Good teachers matter tremendously to their students, and unfortunately, not so good teachers also matter tremendously to their students, just not in a positive way. This is taken from data in Tennessee, but there are countless similar examples from countless similar studies that I could show you. But this shows students who are at the same starting point in grade 3, and that's a very respectable starting point. It's the 50th percentile. These are third graders who are at grade level. And 3 years later, if we track students who had the highest value-add teachers who contributed the most to their students' learning, you see that enormous rise from the 50th percentile to the 90th percentile, while students who were at grade level and had teachers who had the lowest value-add for the next three-year period were at the 37th percentile. So we see that enormous achievement gap open up. And remember, these are kids who started out at grade level, so imagine how that achievement gap only grows wider for kids who aren't. We track state policy in our annual State Teacher Policy Yearbook, which we released our 2011 edition this January. And the last few years have just seen activities on this policy front so dramatic compared to what we'd seen in the past. Next slide, please. In particular, the state's focus on teacher effectiveness policies and policies that put student achievement at the center of those policies has been enormous. Just to give you a sense, and then I'll show you more specifically, we saw 33 states, of course including Minnesota, make changes to their teacher evaluation policy in the last 2 years, including emphasis on both making sure that all teachers, not just probationary teachers, have annual evaluations, and also emphasis on making sure that dismissal was possible if evaluations show teachers are consistently underperforming. So in terms of classroom evaluations, this has been, it's really the when we talk about teacher effectiveness, teacher evaluation has to be at the center, right? If we don't know who's effective, then all the other policies that we tie to it aren't very meaningful. And what we've had for really the past decades were very dysfunctional teacher evaluation systems where all teachers basically receive the same rating regardless of performance and regardless of whether or not students are actually learning in the classroom. So we now see about half the states very specifically connect student achievement, evidence of student learning, and specifically objective evidence to student learning to the teacher evaluation. And Minnesota is among the states that have made sure that's happening in a very significant way. And I just want to clarify, that's not to say that that we think that student achievement should be the be-all, end-all of teacher evaluation. No one thinks teachers should be evaluated based on a single test score or that standardized tests should be the only thing used to measure teacher performance, but we should include that objective evidence. So just to give you a brief sense of the kind of change we've seen in the last 2 years, you can see the big increase in both changes to policy on the frequency and the content of teacher evaluation. Now, where we haven't seen quite so much activity is on the next step policies. You know, it's incredibly important to know who our most effective teachers are, who our weak teachers are, and have better information about everybody in between so we can help everybody grow and improve. But there's still a lot of work to be done on making sure that the policies that connect to teacher evaluation, once we know who's effective, these decisions of consequence are codified in policy. And this pertains specifically to policy around how tenure is awarded, certification, both advancement and renewal, professional development, compensation, and of course the big topic of the day, which is layoff decisions. And I'm just going to briefly talk about each one of those and then spend some more time on layoff decisions. In terms of tenure decisions, a small but growing number of states now require evidence of student learning to be considered in determining whether or not teachers are awarded tenure. The 12 states that require that might seem like a relatively small number, but two years ago that number was basically zero. So this is certainly an area that's getting increasing attention as well. In terms of connecting teacher effectiveness to licensure advancement, again, just a small number of states have taken this up. What's so important, I think, on the licensure front is, we don't want to set the same standard that might cause someone to be dismissed from their position to also cause them to lose their license. Someone might be unsuccessful in one position but be very successful in a different position. So we want to make sure we're setting a different bar there. But generally, states do have requirements for licensure advancement or renewal that are very disconnected from teacher effectiveness, like just taking additional coursework. So we want to make sure that we're moving away from policies that are not grounded in effectiveness and towards those that are. In terms of evaluation requirements around helping teachers to improve, one of the most important things about fixing our teacher evaluation systems is that teachers, I was in the classroom for 10 years and almost never received any actual feedback about what I was doing. Unless you had the opportunity to meet with other teachers informally and get ideas, the evaluation process was almost never about giving you actionable feedback that could affect your practice. And that's what we see across the country. And what we see as states are moving forward on evaluation policies, we want to make sure that central to it is that teachers are being given feedback. And not just if you get a poor evaluation. We want to make sure that all teachers are getting feedback, not just copies of their evaluations. And then we also want to make sure, as Minnesota has done, that there's that connection between the evaluation findings and professional development activities. Professional development tends to be very hit or miss. We do in schools exactly what we tell teachers not to do. You know, we tell teachers not to teach to the middle, yet we tend to plan our professional development activities in that same way, what's perceived as the most common need, rather than actually identifying what individual teachers need. And Minnesota has taken the very important step of making that connection. As far as connecting pay to performance, there are three states that now have directed districts that that their salary schedules must include performance, not just that they can, but that they must include performance in addition to whatever other factors they include. Most states still leave pay up to district discretion. Important to notice that there are still a significant number of states that either through a state salary schedule or other requirements still maintain requirements that teachers with advanced degrees must be compensated for those advanced degrees, even though the research is very strong and clear that for the most part advanced degrees do not make teachers more effective. So turning to the topic of the day, I just wanted to give you that broader introduction. In terms of reduction in force, there are only 11 states at present that specifically require that performance must be considered by districts in determining which teachers are laid off when a reduction of force is required. The other states either are silent and leave it to district discretion, or specifically stipulate that other requirements, other criteria must be met other than performance. And just to give you a sense of what that means in terms of seniority, Minnesota, prior to these bills that are under consideration right now, is among a very small number of states that specifically mandate that seniority must be considered in layoff decisions. Now, the 23 states that leave this to district discretion, we know that the reality is in most of those districts that it is seniority driven, that layoffs are seniority driven. But there are a number of states that make that decision at the state level. There are 15 states now that have made it clear that seniority can be considered as long as it's considered in an appropriate criterion. There are two states, that's Idaho and Utah, that have specifically banned the use of seniority at all in layoff decisions. I'm not sure that, that seems a bit draconian. I don't think there's anything wrong with considering seniority once performance has been considered. So to go in a little bit further on what the issues are around these layoff decisions, the problem with seniority-based layoffs is for the most part, part and parcel, is that they put adult interests before student needs by not looking at teacher effectiveness. We know from analysis after analysis that more effective teachers wind up leaving while less effective teachers stay in seniority-based layoffs. We know that it raises the total number of teachers who must be let go. And we also know, especially in urban districts, that seniority-based layoffs tend to disproportionately impact high-need schools because they tend to have a larger percentage of newer teachers. So what the research shows us, that's a little small. I should have made that a little bigger. As more and more studies have been conducted, we see that the majority of seniority-based layoffs do not align with what would have happened in a performance-driven system. Only a very small percentage of the teachers who would have been laid off in a seniority-based system would also have been laid off in an effectiveness-based system. And I just want to be clear, this is not to suggest that we should be doing reverse seniority and reducing all our most experienced teachers first. It's saying we need to level the playing field and make it about performance. In terms of the numbers, this is from an analysis from Marguerite Rosa, who's out in Washington State. and one of the leading authorities on the economics of schools and classrooms. And this shows how it works out, why that you need to lay off so many more teachers when you do seniority-based layoffs rather than performance-driven layoffs. In a seniority-based layoff, you are starting with your smallest salaries and moving up from there because you're starting with your newest teachers. In a performance-based system, it's basically going to be your average salary that you're reducing because you are, starting with performance. And depending on the reduction that's necessary, you can see how many more teachers you need to reduce. And just to give you a sense of what this looks like in real numbers, not just in the percentages, these are based on some national calculations, not obviously for a particular district. But you can see the real dramatic increases in the number of teachers that you have to lay off when it's done this way. And so just to sum up with the bottom line is we want to make sure that our top performers of all experience levels are protected. I mentioned the disproportionate impact on high-need schools. Frequently our high-need schools are where we've made big investments, where we have real interventions going on, but they may involve very young teachers, but we end up throwing all that out in a seniority-driven system. As I said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with including seniority as long as performance is prioritized. And a lot of the seniority-driven protections that we see come from an age when we didn't have employment laws offering the protections against age discrimination and other forms of discrimination that we now have. And so certainly no district would be able to, do the easy thing and just cut its largest salaries, circumventing performance or anything else and just making the easiest budgetary decision, because that would certainly be age discrimination and be otherwise protected. So I'm going to stop there and be very happy to answer any questions.
Representative Downing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was interesting, and I appreciate a nice brief synopsis there. Going back a couple of slides, you made the comment, there was a slide that showed the current seniority-based model resulting, I thought I read it to say something about 80% of the highest performing teachers. You can go back. Oops, I think it was after all that.
Yes.
So you made the comment that you would not want to go to a reverse seniority based model, and yet if I read this data right, if we actually laid off in reverse seniority order, we would be retaining 84 to 87% of the best teachers. So why wouldn't we do reverse seniority?
Well, I mean, I think we want the system that's going to ensure that we keep all our most effective teachers, right? So that should be the criterion that we base it off. Now, there would be better overlap doing it in the reverse, perhaps. But I think the key is to make sure that we're keeping who's most effective and not risk having anybody let go who's effective over somebody who's less effective.
If I could, it may also be because it's against federal and state law to discriminate in such a manner.
Right.
Well,
the key is
interesting that we're doing ageism in the reverse right now. Anyway, it was just an observation, that statement. And then if I could also, you mentioned ageism as being something that's illegal. And do they, at the federal level, do they consider the cost of the value that employee is providing compared to the cost of the more junior person? Would you be, so let's say there's a person who's very senior who costs me twice as much as somebody who's very senior who costs me twice as much as a business person as the junior person, but the junior person is performing exactly the same amount of work, product, and value for me. Would I be guilty of age discrimination if I let go of the older person because of the cost part of the equation, or is the federal law cost blind with regard to age discrimination?
I think the issue is about patterns. It has to be a pattern of discrimination, and so making the case for one individual is different than saying we needed to lay off 100 workers and they happen to be our 100 oldest workers, that's going to be a pattern of discrimination. So I think when you enter the pattern, then I do think it is relatively cost blind, I must say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I just want to point out that there's a misconception that seniority has to do with age and experience. Seniority has to do with when you were hired. It has nothing to do with your experience. So if you teach in a school district for 12 years and you leave that school district, you then become zero seniority, even though you are 12 years older from when you started and you have 12 years of seniority in that school district, you now will have zero seniority. So it's not attached to age and it's not attached to experience.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to Minnesota.
Thank you.
We're warming things up so people can visit our state more often.
Surely this isn't typical March in Minnesota.
Certainly not at all. I'm wondering a couple of things. One, if and perhaps the chairs can help, you can get copies of the PowerPoints. I suspect those might be available on your website, but if you can make those available to us, I would appreciate it. A smaller point, but you made a statement earlier about advanced degrees that having been shown is not correlated with teacher effectiveness. The National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, however, has promoted for a long time the pursuit of advanced degrees for teachers, and have even created, I think, scholarships and opportunities to do that.
I have to say, there are many, many functions, not the least of which is our salary schedules, which promote teachers pursuing advanced degrees. I'm not aware that the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards specifically advocates for advanced degrees. In fact, in their portfolio for review, I'm not sure that advanced degrees are a criterion at all. The research there, when we look at education research, as you well know, there are so many areas where for every study showing one thing, there's another study that shows the opposite or conclude something very different. On the area of master's degrees, there is a real preponderance of research evidence, and the reason is, and it seems very counterintuitive. Why wouldn't more coursework, more instruction, more in-depth training make you more effective? It seems so logical that it would. And what we see is that most teachers do not pursue a degree designed to promote, to advance their instruction.
Excuse me just for a second. Could the members turn off their cell phones and maybe even get the iPads away from the mics? I don't know. There's some kind of interference that I think is driving everyone crazy. So sorry to
interrupt. No problem. What we see is that elementary teachers, less than 10% of elementary teachers who get an advanced degree get it in a content area, and only about a quarter of secondary teachers get their advanced degree in a content area. Generally, teachers either pursue a very generic curriculum and instruction area, which is sort of, nothing in particular to what they actually teach, or they pursue administration because it's a pathway towards advancing them up the career ladder. There is research that the research when secondary math teachers pursue an advanced degree, there is a correlation. Pursue an advanced degree in mathematics. There is a correlation with teacher effectiveness, but overwhelmingly, that is not the kinds of degrees that teachers pursue.
Would it be accurate, because I've read some of the same research, to characterize it as as long as it's content-specific or field-specific or applicable to the course that you actually are instructing, then there is some limited research that shows that that actually does increase effectiveness.
But really, only in mathematics fields. Even in, we haven't seen that correlation in studies in English or history or other areas like that. Now, it may be that it hasn't been studied well enough to show that. So the only ones we've really seen that result for is math. We have a meta-analysis on our website. Others have done it, have done similar things, really showing all the research and all the, in most cases, negative findings when you correlate with effectiveness.
In Minnesota, we don't have that kind of specific requirement, so we spend considerable amounts of resources on things that have little value, at least in the research. If you could provide that to the committee,
sure,
that'd be great, and we
to.
Can distribute that to the...
And many members. Districts pay teachers for the coursework, and then they pay a premium after the coursework is completed for advancing up the salary schedule. And, you know, I think for a long time we didn't have this research evidence, and it intuitively made sense. Why wouldn't we pay teachers for getting more training? But now we really know differently.
I've got a couple of questions. You had showed some slides that showed Minnesota is kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of our correlation to student achievement and our dependence upon various assessments. Some of the, I would say, opponents of tying any kind of high risk or high stakes, excuse me, decision making is that they characterize as our system too dependent upon assessment. How would you characterize, in your own words, I guess, Minnesota's assessment system and how it weights student achievement versus some other measures?
Yeah, I think the key thing is we're trying to build systems that ensure that teachers, that if there isn't evidence that kids in the classroom are learning, it's not possible to get an effective rating. And, you know, there isn't one right way to do that. States are approaching it very differently, some through formula-based approaches like you have in Minnesota, some through scoring mechanisms that say very clearly, you know, if this happens on the student piece, then this has to happen in the overall rating. You know, we don't really know what the magic percentages are. It does strike me at 35% that there's still a lot in play, that it could be quite possible to be rather poor on the objective measurements and still wind up with an overall effective rating. So it has certainly left room for the question mark.
I've got another question. You had said that there are 23 states in your slide that's predominantly a locally based decision-making process. There's no state mandate. And in an overwhelming amount of those districts, what is locally negotiated just happens to be predominantly seniority-based, or at the very least, not centered on student achievement. Could you kind of delve into that issue and maybe... give us your opinion as to why that may be.
Well, I mean, as I said, I think that that a lot of the things that we've seen in contract negotiations, the salary schedule, for example, I think the reason we have salary schedules in teaching is because not that long ago, in you know, the relatively recent past, it was perfectly acceptable to pay male teachers and female teachers different rates, to pay elementary teachers and secondary teachers different rates, to pay married teachers and unmarried teachers different rates, because we didn't have protections that made those things not possible, and so instead you negotiated them and you built those protections in. I think the seniority protections got negotiated very, very similarly, because there wasn't protections against age discrimination or other things that made sure you didn't just lop off your highest salaries and were done with it. I think also when we look at union membership, you know, there is a sense of you work your way up and then you earn more protections and you've been there longer and so you're entitled to stay. You know, now we have protections that wouldn't make it possible just to lop off your your highest salaries or disproportionately impact the oldest workers in that or any other field. I also think that in the scheme of negotiation, seniority-based layoffs were just simply what was done, and it never occurred to people in a lot of places to think about the impact of that. And frankly, some places, you know, if 99% of your teachers are getting the same evaluation rating, it'd be hard to do a performance-driven system anyway. So I think it just wasn't even on people's radars. But now that we've seen this big shift in effectiveness policies, combined with, unfortunately, our economic situation, make putting layoffs back on the table, where in a lot of communities it wasn't something being dealt with for many years, it's really brought it back into focus.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jacobs, among your slides, the one that showed how states determine layoffs, six states among them Minnesota that mandate seniority, and five states where seniority is the sole factor for layoffs. Among those 11, is teacher evaluation now a tool that can be used? Or could you provide us with that if you don't have it at your disposal?
So it's a mixed bag. And actually, I've never looked at that before. What a great question. It is a mixed bag. Some states, like New York, Louisiana, that are in the mix there, certainly have moved forward on the teacher evaluation front. Others, California, West Virginia, haven't. So, I will send you that state by state.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Jacobs, could you speak to some of the? I know there are some states who changed the law as it relates to this and left it to the districts. I don't know what can be done about that, if anything can be. Have left it to the districts to negotiate an alternative plan. Could you speak to those states that have done that? And what I've seen, the trend is really a continuation of the status quo. I mean, absent state, the state backup for those district officials to actually implement this paradigm shift, what you've seen is just a continuation of kind of the old union work rules. Is that a correct?
I think that's right. I think there's been a real lesson learned in some states that I think New York is a prime example where much was left to be negotiated. This isn't specifically to layoffs. This was on teacher evaluation a little broader. And where very little was resolved or moved forward through negotiation, partly in the current economic situation, there isn't a lot of reason to negotiate a new contract, particularly if the conditions of your old contract stay in force if you don't negotiate at a time when raises are not so likely, and if anything you're going to be talking about givebacks, well, then just staying away from the table and not reaching agreement becomes a very viable option. And in other places, we've seen just not very forward-looking, reform-minded agreements come out, even though clearly the state law was pretty clear in its intentions to move things forward. Some states have now looked, as I know you have in these bills, what's been called sort of a shot clock rule, that if you can't come to agreement by a certain time frame, then something else happens, whether it's a state plan or some sort of default plan. I think that is very wise and something we hadn't really thought about before we started to see how this was playing out in some states.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jacobs, in that first slide that you showed where you made the point that ineffectiveness takes a toll on our students, and it was the Sander Rivers study of 1996. Has Tennessee had teacher evaluation in place since that time? Or, I'm just curious about the collection of the data and whether teacher evaluation played a part in that determination.
That's such a great question. So Tennessee has been collecting the data that long. Tennessee has probably been doing it, and not probably, Tennessee has been doing it longer than anybody. However, they never use that data for evaluation or any other real meaningful purpose. up until very recently, up until legislation they passed 2 years ago. So they have a longitudinal trove of data, unlike most other states, but it is very new that they are acting on it. Thank you.
One of the last slides that you had was the seniority mandate and the impact on teacher employment. Some of the opponents of this bill have kind of said that the status quo system and the seniority mandate is actually a teacher protection, and that it somehow is an anti-teacher position to propose some performance-based metric. It seems to me that the data actually shows that the seniority mandate actually exacerbates the job loss of teachers and in fact decreases the number of teachers who are employed in those districts that are mandated to go about that hiring practice. Is that an accurate estimation of the data?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, that it causes, it almost always will cause, you'd have to raise your total number of layoffs when you do it that way. And, you know, I think, I'd say, my organization doesn't say, and certainly your bills doesn't say, take seniority off the table within a performance category. I think that is completely legitimate. We want to, all things being tied, we're going to reward the people who have been here longest. That seems quite legitimate. We've seen things in district contracts that talk about, now this is when it's seniority driven, but all things being tied, you don't even use performance as the tiebreaker. You literally flip a coin or go by who has the sequence of Social Security numbers, you know, who has, so you leave it completely up to random chance. This is the, certainly those things aren't teacher friendly either.
Right. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jacobs, have you done any research on the effect of teacher effectiveness on priority schools, on schools that are really struggling, low-performing schools, as opposed to just a middle-of-the-road or even high-performing suburban schools?
So we haven't done that research, but the Education Trust, which focuses so primarily on high needs schools and schools that serve disadvantaged populations, has done an analysis. There's a great deal of information available on their website showing just how disproportionately such layoffs impact high needs schools. There was a recent settlement of a case in Los Angeles brought by civil rights groups, again showing how dramatically seniority-driven layoffs, which are mandated as the only criterion in California, basically were gutting high-need schools, leaving them with 25% of their teaching force, while barely touching more affluent schools.
Thank you.
And just to add to that, in environments where the predominant teacher base is much wider than their high minority communities. For example, you have communities in our in the Twin Cities that have 70-80% minority students, while only 20% of the teacher base is minority teachers. You could say almost that the seniority mandate is an institutional barrier to entry for change in the dynamic and mix of those teachers in those districts. Just by virtue of seniority favoring the much older and much more, much wider teacher population. So I think that's another dynamic about that. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to the point that you brought up with regard to the cost of laying off more senior teachers. When I first heard Ms. Jacobs talk about that you ended up having to lay off many more teachers because they cost more, I became concerned because I know many have expressed concern around that this would, in effect, be a tool that districts could use to lay off the most expensive teachers. And I think that's why you see in both the House and Senate bill we've added language to try and protect against that. I was heartened to hear that, in fact, that wasn't the case, that when you looked at the data, looking from effectiveness first, you merely got to the average. And so do you want to just expound on that a little bit to make certain that that's clear?
Yeah, I think that's right. So when you are doing performance-driven labs, and certainly when you're starting with your ineffective category, you're going to have a mix of your least expensive teachers all the way up to your most expensive teachers. And so as you move through the categories, hopefully not having, hopefully no place is having such epic layoffs that they're moving through too many categories, but because you're moving through through the range, you end up with something a lot closer to the average salary.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jacobs, some of us at this table feel a sense of urgency in adopting this policy that we now have in conference committee, and yet the critics say that we're ahead of ourselves, that teacher evaluation is still being created at the local level or even the default, and principal evaluation is not yet kicked in locally. And so if you're able to, would you comment on why this is the time to go forward with this kind of policy?
No, I think that's absolutely right. So even if we're still using our less than ideal, by a large stretch, evaluation systems that only show a very small percentage of teachers being ineffective, why wouldn't we want that small percentage to be the first ones to go? Why would we want them to have any protection regardless of their years of experience, how long they've been in the system? So we may quickly exhaust who we're able to identify as ineffective if 99% of teachers in a district have the same, all have satisfactory ratings, but my goodness, we should be starting with that 1% who are ineffective, who by some measure we've already said are unsatisfactory. Why would we want to keep them? So I think we can certainly move forward even while we wait to adopt our more sophisticated and more effectiveness-based systems.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, follow-up.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Jacobs, if I follow my line of thinking, and if I were still in the classroom and I were part of a bargaining unit negotiating now with my school board this new layoff policy, I think that I would want to take a careful look at my local plan as we're creating that for teacher evaluation, because I might want to, along with my colleagues, make some different decisions on the teacher eval, knowing now that licensure evaluation and seniority will be equal parts of a layoff policy. And so I think that it's incumbent upon our teachers to realize that they're going to have a greater say in all of this, and I hope that they don't choose the default. I'm hoping that all school boards and bargaining units can come to an agreement on a teacher evaluation and subsequently on the layoff policy, because they are the key players in this. And they can have such influence, and I know how much I would want to be a part of this if I were still in the classroom. As I look at what we enacted into law a year ago in teacher evaluation and weighing those and figuring out that evaluation system, and it's a comment more or less, but I think that we're missing the boat when we don't help our teachers to understand that they're the key players in all of this. And ultimately, our students win, but they are the key players. The first time in Minnesota history, teachers are going to have a say in a layoff system. For the first time in Minnesota history, teachers are going to have the ability to design their own evaluation system. And they have to a certain extent so far, but not to the extent that we laid out in our language adopted last year. So, I would celebrate, I guess, if I were still in the classroom, knowing that I get a chance to have a say, and it's not going to be one-sided. And I don't know if this is happening in other states. Are they having these discussions, or, is anyone going down the same path we are, trying to create before it actually is implemented?
I agree with you. This is a real opportunity to really change the way we've been doing things. What we know from survey after survey and study after study, teachers want to work with other great teachers.
Okay.
No one feels good when the teacher next door isn't getting the job done. Yes, sometimes there's that feeling of solidarity that you sort of close your door and try to pretend it's not there, but given the opportunity to, teachers would surround themselves with effective colleagues. And this is an opportunity to make sure that, you know, year in and year out through the evaluation system and in the, you know, no one wants to see a reduction in force happen, but if it does, to make sure that it's your effective colleagues who stay. Mm-hmm. I think that states are working hard to, this is terribly challenging. There's so many moving parts. It's a lot to figure out. It's a challenge to bring everybody to the table, get all the voices involved, and still come out with something that you can then actually practically implement. But I really commend you for taking this on. It's so, so important. And we know, if there's one thing we know from I started by saying, for every education study that shows this, there's something else that shows something else. Well, one thing we know indisputably is how much teachers matter to the success of their students.
Thank you. Representative Downey and then Representative Marini.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're focusing very specifically on layoffs here in this bill and trying to keep the discussion focused on that. You mentioned that there's probably five different dimensions to where effectiveness could be utilized, and one of those was compensation. And I think there's it's actually a direct linkage between compensation and layoffs, which you've pointed to. And so I'm just curious, are there any teacher compensation systems where seniority and advanced degrees are not maybe kind of the driving factor of compensation?
So the national model that I would recommend you to is the Harrison School District in Colorado Springs, Colorado, which has implemented in complete cooperation between the teachers union and the school district. It was not a top-down mandate in any sense. The compensation system is 100% performance-based. There are no other factors. A third-year teacher can make considerably more than a 12th-year teacher if that's what the evaluation system shows. It's a 9 rating systems, and your compensation depends on where you fall on that 9-part scale. The Fordham Institute actually just put out a paper written by Mike Miles, who's the superintendent of that district. It's on the Fordham Institute's website. It is really quite a fascinating model, and the level of cooperation that it was produced with, I think, is very interesting as well.
Representative Mariani.
Oh, Mr. Chair, can I just have a follow-up?
Yep. Is that,
thank you. I'm going to make a really brash statement, and you can give me your response. But so I don't know if I haven't been paying attention in committee for 3 years or if I've just never heard these two pieces of data, but that it seems like there's an 80% reverse correlation between seniority and performance, if I'm understanding your data right, and there's almost zero correlation between advanced degrees and performance. And so it seems to me that we in Minnesota largely, if not almost entirely, drive compensation based on two things that at best are neutral, and probably from what you've presented here, actually a negative correlation to effectiveness. And both of those two things conspire to increase the number of layoffs. And not only that, they tend to gut our highest need schools of the staff that they need to succeed. And so I ask, when you say, gee, all things being equal and tied, why wouldn't we take the lowest cost teacher if everything is tied? It almost seems like we're doing exactly the reverse of what we should be. And any other profession, and we do have a constitutional mandate for an efficient and effective system of public schools, not just that we have one that serves everybody, but efficient and effective. How do we honor that constitutional mandate and still say that all things being tied, seniority should prevail? It seems to me it should be the reverse.
Well, I don't think, I mean, certainly the research doesn't tell us one or the other, what to do in the event of a tie. The research isn't going to tell us that. I think some places feel, and I this is how I feel as well, that teachers, it is a public service field, and you do want teachers to feel that, you know, they're not going to be shown the door at a certain age or at a certain point in their career to bring new blood in. That said, if a district wanted to rule out considering seniority at all, you know, certainly the research wouldn't say that's a mistake. And to add to your to what you were saying about you know, the compensation system, the research is also pretty clear that years of experience doesn't well correlate, which is the other thing we base our salary schedules on. You know, the first few years matter a lot. Teachers get a lot better early in their career. But after that, it's pretty much a plateau, yet we continue to reward based on.
And just real quick, the new teacher projects, February 2011 release actually does recommend seniority as the secondary criteria in the research that they had compiled, and I think that's the will of this committee, and both obviously reflected in both bodies, is to weigh that as a significant portion as one of three parts of the decision making process. Representative Mariani, and then Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do want to caution us a little bit because we're kind of ranging, and it's good to have a good ranging conversation, but we don't have a proposal on the table for 100%
performance,
retention of teachers based on performance and tying that to high stakes outcomes. And so I don't want us to get in trouble publicly here. So I really want to stay focused on, you know, what we have before us. And I think that, you know, Minnesota's not unique, you know, in terms of having this strong emphasis on local control relative to our independent school districts. At the same time, we acknowledge that, you know, that authority flows from the state. So we have a responsibility to direct. So I want to throw out kind of three things here that I'm kind of wrestling with. So one is, right now we're told that 40% of our school districts have negotiated in some form or another in Minnesota on this issue. I don't know the history of how long we've been doing that, and I'm hoping maybe you might know. And so the question there, but there's going to be three parts here. The question related to that is, what can the council tell us relative to desirable outcomes, if you will, related to the 40% of school districts negotiating this issue out? And earlier, you mentioned, and you posed it, I think, objectively and fairly as a question, you know, not knowing where the magical score is tied to, you know, our primary student assessment systems, which is basically used to standardize assessments. And I think you suggested that, well, you know, intuitively 35% might not be good enough. What can you tell us relative to actually measured outcomes about the 35% versus the 50%? The third part to that is whether it's 50%, which I believe is what the council, you know, generally proposes, right? It begs the question about, so what are the other elements? You know, so what else should we be mindful of what does research tell you about what the most important parts of all that is? And so here's Representative Mariani's convoluted kind of, you know, thought processes is, how do we tie all that together in terms of assuring ourselves that we're following good scientific approaches here? You know, one of the things that I'm not a scientist, but one of the things that that I've been encouraged is, you know, Carlos, don't make, you know, bets, you know, use data as much as possible. And sometimes it does take a while to be able to collect that data and make sure you have a valid baseline. So I'm kind of looking for kind of what the valid baseline answers are to those different elements that you want. I hope you can track my...
Yeah, so let me try. So first on the 40% of districts in Minnesota, that I can't really comment on. I just don't know the history of collective bargaining in Minnesota or really anywhere else for that matter. But one thing we do know is when we've looked at teacher contracts over time, we tend to see that once something is negotiated a certain way, it tends to stay that way. You get new administrators in, and they have sort of signature issues that come up. But remarkably, contracts change little over time, and so probably this is how it became subject to negotiation. It's probably been that way for a long time. Would be my guess, but I don't know. On the other question, I think you raised something really important. How valid the overall evaluation system is going to be with the student evidence piece at 35% is very much going to depend on what the rest of the evaluation system is. And, as I mentioned, I think multiple measures are very, very important, but they have to be good measures. And the things we've been using, we know objectively, are not good. You know, we've been looking, when you look at the evaluation instruments in use across the country, we tend to see checklists that have almost no connection to instructional practice at all. I talked about how teachers don't get feedback. Well, the evaluation instrument isn't designed to lead to any feedback. It's focused on things like the bulletin boards. Are they attractive? Was it too warm or too cold in the classroom, which is something the teacher can almost never control anyway. They focus on the teacher's appearance and personal hygiene, but not actually, are the questioning techniques what research tells us help children learn the best. So a big part of this is going to be what the other objective measures are that we allow to be used, and what we do with the observation piece, right? The evidence is pretty clear that teacher observation is a very important part of evaluation. It's where that feedback is going to come from, right? Your value-added scores might tell you that you're a lot stronger at teaching math than you are at teaching reading if you're a third-grade teacher, but it's not going to tell you what to do about that. You know, it's not going to tell you where your actual strengths and weaknesses are. That's going to come from the observation instrument. And what we see, and there's great research coming out of the Methods of Effective Teaching Project, which is a very large research project funded by the Gates Foundation, and they have been showing how some specific observation instruments are stronger and weaker than others, and how they well correlate, with student results and lead to much better feedback for teachers than others do. We see that the training of the observers matters a lot. You know, in a lot of high schools, we send the assistant principal, whose background was as a social studies teacher, into the math teacher's classroom, and they don't know what good math instruction looks like, and how could they couldn't give good feedback. It's not their background. So it's having a good instrument and having well-trained observers use the instrument is a big part of it. And I think it's how the systems overall come together that's going to really be so important in whether or not we're really getting the results that we want. And, based on what we know from our student achievement data, right? We know value-added data tells us some teachers dramatically outperform others. So if we have systems where basically everybody's still getting the same rating, almost nobody's identified ineffective, and almost nobody's identified highly effective, then we haven't accomplished what we wanted to at all, and we really need to take a look at the instruments that have been designed.
Mr. Chairperson, thank you. If I can follow up then, so now then to tie that together, and I agree, it makes intuitive sense to me, having a good instrument and well-trained individuals to implement the instrument, that makes sense to me. What I'm struggling with is how soon should one move toward a high-stakes decision with the possibility that it takes a while to build a good instrument, number one, with, you know, maybe 35% isn't. Maybe it should be 40. Maybe it should be 10. And to make sure that we have well-trained people. I get that systemic piece of it. I think that's right. So what can the council tell us in terms of what sort of a prudent window that we should use? Is it prudent to immediately implement? Is it prudent to wait a generation? Is it prudent, what can you
That's such an important question. I think we have to remember that this is generated from an urgency to act because we don't have the level of student achievement that we want, and especially not for our highest needs kids, and from motivated by a feeling that our teacher evaluation systems are just completely broken and not getting the job done at all. Yes, we are a ways away from having perfect systems, but we don't need to be so far away from having a lot better systems. And those a lot better systems can be telling us a lot of valuable information very soon. Now, how soon is too soon to make high-stakes decisions? You know, that's a hard question to answer. Some places have felt pretty comfortable acting immediately. That the urgency outweighs the perhaps not having every I dotted in the instrument. Other places have taken a more cautious approach to that. I think that the key thing is that if we're looking too far down the pike, then we don't have a real accountability system at all.
Well, I think last year I gave a speech or a presentation to the conference, the Data Quality Campaign Conference, and I compared data to data in the education realm to fine china in your home. And everybody like fine china. Everyone likes to have it. Nobody wants to use it, of course. And I feel like that's how we've been in the education realm, or at least it becomes controversial. It seems to me that when you're engaged in any paradigm shift, moving away from an adult-centric system centered around union work rules to a student-centric system centered around the achievement of those students, that inherently there's going to be unanswered questions until you attempt to implement the system. And what the critics and opponents of these things have done is say, well, because you simply cannot answer all of the questions about what may happen when these changes are made, that's reason enough not to make them. And to me, it seems as policymakers that it's our job to put forward proposals that are centered around core values, and values that say that, you know, we're no longer going to place a blindfold over our eyes and ignore the results of our largest public investment. And we called you and your organization here today in particular because of the work and recognition that you gave to the work of this body and the administration last session. And I know that the commissioner and governor himself cited your organization numerous times after you had recognized the state of Minnesota for the positive progress that we made. And I think everyone, including the administration, recognizes you and your organization as a highly credible source for positive education reform in the country. And so we're glad that you're able to come here today and speak about House File 1870 and how that impacts student evaluations and the work that we did last session as well, and make recommendations. I think the senators in particular have some business to attend to, and I think we'll adjourn the meeting for today unless there's any other member questions. So, all right. Meeting is adjourned.